Chapter 32. To Keep the Bargain. Birgitta was leaning against the stone wall of the three-story house, thinking sadly of Geidel, when the bundle of emotions and physical sensations in the back of her head, her awareness of Elaine, suddenly spasmed. That was the only word for it. Whatever it was lasted just a moment, but afterward the bond was full of limpness. Elaine was conscious but unsteady. She was unafraid, however. Still, Birgitta threw back her cloak and moved to the corner to peer up Full Moon Street. Elaine could be too brave for her own good. The hardest thing about being Elaine's warder was keeping her from endangering herself beyond need. Nobody was indestructible, but the bloody woman thought she bloody well was. Her sigil should have been an iron lion rather than a golden lily. That light shone in the window, spilling a pale pool into the narrow street, and there was not a sound except for a cat yowling somewhere in the night.
"Saritha feels muzzy," Ned Yarman muttered beside her.
The tall young warder's boyish face was a grim shadowed mask inside the hood of his cloak. "She feels weak." Birgitta became aware of the other warders crowding her close, stone-faced and hard-eyed. That was clear enough even by moonlight. Something had happened to all of the Aes Sedai, it seemed. But what? The Lady Elaine said she'd shout if she needed us, she told them, as much to reassure herself as anything else. Even if both Carianna and Saritha were dark friends, they would have been helpless to do anything linked, and apparently whatever had happened to them as well. Burn her! She should have insisted that she and the other warders go along.
"Carianna won't be pleased if we interfere needlessly," Venner Kosan said quietly.
Blade slim and dark, with touches of white in his tightly curled black hair and short beard, he appeared completely at ease.
"I say we wait. She feels confident, whatever's going on."
"More so than she did going in," Sierralar Juna added, earning him a sharp glance from Venner.
Still short of his middle years, Sierral seemed all bones, though his shoulders were wide. Birgitta nodded. Elaine was confident, too. But then Elaine would feel self-assured walking an unraveling rope stretched over a pit full of sharp stakes. A dog began barking in the distance, and the yowling cat went silent, but other dogs answered the first in a spreading ripple that faded away as suddenly as it had begun. They waited, with Birgitta fretting in silence. Suddenly Venner growled an oath and shed his cloak. The next instant his blade was in his hand and he was running up the street, followed by Sierral and Taven, cloaks billowing behind, their blades bared too. Before they had gone two steps, Jaime gave a wild cry. Unsheathing his sword, he threw his cloak down and raced after the other three at a speed that belied his age. Bellowing with rage, Ned ran too, the steel in his fist glittering in the moonlight. Fury stabbed through the bond, like the battle fury that took some men, and sadness too, but still no fear. Birgitta heard the soft rasp of swords being unsheathed behind her and spun cloak flaring.
"Put those up. They're no use here."
"I know what the warders running in means as well as you, my lady," Yurith said in courtly accents, obeying smoothly, and with clear reluctance. Lean and as tall as most men, the Saldaean denied being nobly born, but whenever the conversation came around to what she had done before swearing the oath as a hunter for the horn, she always gave one of her rare smiles and changed the subject. She was skilled with that sword, however.
"If the Aes Sedai are dying..."
"Elaine is alive," Birgitta cut in. "Alive and in trouble. She's our concern now, but we'll need a lot more swords to rescue her. And more than swords."
"Somebody collar that man!"
Two guardswomen seized Hark's coat before he could slip away into the darkness. Apparently he had no wish to stay near where Aes Sedai had died. Neither did she.
"Gather the extra horses and follow me," she said, swinging into Arrow's saddle. "And ride like fire!"
She suited her words, digging her heels into the rangy gray gelding's flanks without waiting. It was a wild gallop through dark, twisting streets where people were just beginning to appear. She reined Arrow around the few carts and wagons out this early, but men and women had to leap from her path, often shaking fists and shouting curses.
She only urged the gelding for more speed, her cloak flapping behind. Before she reached the Mondel gate, Elaine was moving. She had been uncertain at first, but there could be no mistaking it now. Elaine was moving northeast at about walking speed. The bond said she was too wobbly to walk far, maybe to walk at all, but a wagon would make the same pace. The sky was turning gray. How long before she could gather what was needed? In the inner city, the street spiraled inward, rising past towers glittering in 100 colors toward the golden domes and pale spires of the royal palace atop the highest of Camelin's hills. As she galloped around the rim of the Queen's Plaza, soldiers stared at her. They were being fed from black kettles atop push barrows, cooks ladling some sort of brown stew onto tin plates, and every man she could see wore his breastplate and had his helmet hanging from his sword hilt. Good. Every moment saved was a moment toward saving Elaine. Two lines of guardswomen were practicing the sword in the Queen's stable yard when she galloped in, but the lath blade stopped rattling when she flung herself out of the saddle, let Arrow's reins drop, and ran toward the colonnade. "Hadora, run tell the windfinders to meet me in the map room right away," she shouted without slowing. "All of them! Sanetta, you do the same for Captain Gaibon, and have another horse saddled for me." Arrow was played out for today. She was past the columns by that time, but she did not look back to see whether they were obeying. They would be. She raced through tapestry-hung hallways and up sweeping marble stairs, got lost and shouted curses as she retraced her steps at a run. Liveried serving men and women gaped as they dodged out of her way. At last she reached the lion-carved doors of the map room, where she paused only long enough to tell the two burly guardsmen on duty to admit the windfinders as soon as they appeared, then went in. Gaibon was already there, in his burnished breastplate with the three golden knots on his shoulder, and Dialin, delicately holding her blue silk skirts up as she moved, the pair of them frowning at the huge mosaic map, where well over a dozen red disks marked the city's northern wall. Never before had there been so many assaults at once, not even 10, but Birgitta spared the disks barely a glance. "Gaibon, I need every horse and halberd you can muster," she said, unpinning her cloak and tossing it down on her long writing table. "The crossbowmen and archers will have to handle anything that crops up by themselves for a few hours. Elaine's been captured by Dark Friend Aes Sedai, and they're trying to carry her out of the city." Some of the clerks and messengers began murmuring, but Mistress Anford silenced them with a sharp order to see to their work. Birgitta eyed the colorful map in the floor, measuring distances. Elaine seemed to be moving toward the Sunrise Gate and the road to the River Arranon, but even if they used one of the smaller gates, they had gone too far to be aiming at anything but the eastern wall. "They'll probably have her through the gates by the time we're ready to move. We're going to travel to just this side of the ridge east of the city, and take what was going to happen out of the streets, away from people's homes. It would be better out in the open in any case. In that tangle of streets with horsemen and halberdmen jammed together, there would be too many people to get in the way, too much chance of accidents." Gaibon nodded, already issuing terse orders that brown-clad clerks copied down hastily for him to sign and passed to young messengers in red and white, who went running as soon as the paper was in hand. The boys' faces were frightened. Birgitta had no time for her own fear. Elaine felt none, and she was a prisoner. Sadness, yes, but no fear. "We certainly need to rescue Elaine," Dialin said calmly. "But she'll hardly thank you if you give Aramilla Camelin by doing it. Not counting the men in the towers and holding the gates, almost half the trained soldiers and armsmen in the city are on the northern wall. If you strip away the rest, one more attack will gain a stretch of the wall. Crossbows and bows alone won't stop them. Once they have that, Aramilla's forces will pour into the city, enough to overwhelm what you propose to leave. You will have neatly reversed our positions and worsened ours. Aramilla will have Camelin, and Elaine will be outside without enough armsmen to get back in. Unless these dark friends have somehow smuggled an army inside Camelin, a few hundred men will do as well as thousands." Birgitta scowled at her. She'd never been able to like Dialin. She did not know why, exactly, but Dialin had just made her bristle at first sight. She was fairly certain the other woman felt the same about her. She could never say up without Dialin saying down. "You care about putting Elaine on the throne, Dialin. I care about keeping her alive to mount that throne. Or not, so long as she's alive. I owe her my life, and I won't let hers trickle away in dark friend hands.
Dialin sniffed and went back to studying the red discs as if she could see the soldiers fighting, her frown deepening the lines at the corners of her eyes.
Birgitta clasped her hands behind her back and forced herself to stand still. She wanted to pace with impatience.
Elaine was still trundling toward the sunrise gate.
"There's something you need to know, Gaibon. We'll be facing at least two Aes Sedai, likely more, and they may have a weapon, a Turangreal that makes balefire. Have you ever heard of that?"
"Never. It sounds dangerous, though."
"Oh, it is. Dangerous enough that it's prohibited for Aes Sedai. In the War of the Shadow, even Dark Friends stopped using it."
She barked a bitter laugh. All she knew of balefire now was what Elaine had told her. It had come from her in the first place, yet that only made matters worse.
Would all of her memories go?
She did not think she had lost any recently, but how would she know if she had? She could remember bits of the founding of the White Tower, pieces of what she and Gaidel had done to help it be founded, but nothing before that. All of her earlier memories were yesterday's smoke.
"Well, at least we'll have Aes Sedai of our own," Gaibon said, signing another order.
"They're all dead, except for Elaine," she told him flatly. There was no way to gild that.
Dialin gasped, her face growing pale. One of the clerks clasped her hands to her mouth, and another knocked over his ink jar. The ink fanned across the tabletop in a black stream and began dripping onto the floor. Rather than reprimanding the man, Mr. Sanford steadied herself with a hand on another clerk's writing table.
"I hope to make up for that," Birgitta went on. "But I can't promise anything except that we're going to lose men today. Maybe a lot of men."
Gaibon straightened.
His expression was thoughtful, his hazel eyes steady.
"That will make for an interesting day," he said finally.
"But we'll get the daughter heir back, whatever the cost."
A solid man, Charles Gaibon, and brave. He had demonstrated that often enough on the walls. Too good-looking for her taste, of course. Birgitta realized she had begun pacing back and forth across the mosaic and stopped. She knew nothing of being a general, whatever Elaine thought, but she knew that showing nerves could infect others with them. Elaine was alive. That was all that was important. Alive and moving further away by the minute. The left-hand door opened, and one of the burly guardsmen announced that Julania Fote and Karyla Sir Tofny had returned. Gaibon hesitated, looking to her, but when she said nothing, he told the man to admit them. They were very different women, in appearance at least, though each carried a wooden walking staff. Julania was plump and pretty, with touches of white in her dark hair, while Karyla was short and slim, with tilted green eyes and fiery red curls. Birgitta wondered whether those were their real names. These kinswomen changed names as easily as other women changed stockings. They wore plain woolens, suitable for country peddlers, which each had been in the past, and each was a keen observer, skilled at taking care of herself. They could talk their way out of most situations, but their simple belt knives were not the only blades they carried, and they could surprise a strong man with what they could do with those walking staffs. Both offered curtsies. Julania's skirts and cloak were damp and splashed with mud around the hem.
"Elorian, Luon, and Abella began breaking camp early this morning, my lady," she said. "I only stayed long enough to make sure of their direction, north, before coming to report."
"The same is true with Aemlyn, Arathella, and Pellavar, my lady," Karyla added. "They're coming for Caemlyn."
Birgitta did not need to examine the large map spread out on the table with its markers. Depending on how muddy the roads were, how much rain they had to contend with, they could reach the city by that afternoon.
"You've done well, both of you. Go find yourselves hot baths."
"Do you think they've had a change of heart?" she asked Dialin once the two women had left.
"No,"
the woman replied without hesitation, then sighed and shook her head.
"I fear the most likely thing is that Elorian has convinced the others to support her for the Lion Throne. They may be thinking to defeat Aramilla and take over the siege. They have half again her numbers and double ours."
She let that hang. There was no need to say the rest. Even using kinswomen to shift men, they would be hard-pressed to hold the wall against that many.
"First we get Elaine back," Then we can worry about that lot, Birgitta said. Where were those bloody windfinders?
No sooner did she have the thought than they were padding into the room behind Shanella, a riotous rainbow of silks. Except for Renaila, last in line in her linens, yet a red blouse, green trousers, and a deep yellow sash made her bright enough, though even Rainin, a round-cheeked young woman with just half a dozen golden medallions dangling onto her cheek, made Renaila's honor chain look bare. Renaila's face wore an expression of stoic endurance.
I do not appreciate being threatened, Shanella said angrily, sniffing the golden scent box on its golden chain around her neck. Her dark cheeks were flushed. That guardswoman said if we did not run, she would kick. Never mind what she said exactly. It was a threat, and I will not be... Elaine has been captured by dark friend Aes Sedai, Birgitta cut in. I need you to make a gateway for the men who are going to rescue her.
A murmur rose among the other windfinders. Shanella gestured sharply, but only Renaila fell silent. The others just lowered their voices to whispers to her obvious displeasure. By the medallions crowding their honor chains, several of them matched Shanella's rank.
Why did you summon all of us for one gateway? She demanded. I keep the bargain, you can see. I brought everyone as you ordered, but why do you need more than one?
Because you're all going to form a circle and make a gateway big enough to take thousands of men and horses. That was one reason.
Shanella stiffened, and she was not alone.
Curin, her face like a black stone, practically quivered with outrage, and Risale, normally a very dignified woman, did quiver. Senina, with her weathered face and old marks indicating she once had worn more than 6 earrings and fatter ones, fingered the jeweled dagger thrust behind her green sash.
Soldiers? Shanella said indignantly. That is forbidden. Our bargain says we will take no part in your war. Zaida Din Parida Blackwing commanded it so. And now that she is mistress of the ships, that command carries even greater weight. Use the kinswomen. Use the Aes Sedai.
Birgitta stepped close to the dark woman, looking her straight in the eyes. The kin were useless for this. None of them had ever used the power as a weapon. They might not even know how.
The other Aes Sedai are dead, she said softly.
Someone behind her moaned, one of the clerks.
What is your bargain worth if Elaine is lost?
Aramilla certainly won't honor it.
Keeping her voice steady saying that took effort. It wanted to shake with anger, shake with fear.
She needed these women, but she could not let them know why, or Elaine would be lost.
What will Zaida say if you ruin her bargain with Elaine?
Shanella's tattooed hand half-lifted the piercework scent box to her nose again, then let it fall among her many jeweled necklaces. From what Birgitta knew of Zaida Din Parida, she would be more than displeased with anyone who wrecked that bargain, and it was beyond doubtful that Shanella wished to face the woman's anger, yet she only looked pensive.
Very well, she said after a moment. For transport only, though. It is agreed?
She kissed the fingertips of her right hand, prepared to seal the bargain.
You only need do what you want, Birgitta said, turning away.
Gaibon, it's time. They must have her to the gate by now. Gaibon buckled on his sword, took up his helmet and steel-backed gauntlets, and followed her and Dailin out of the map room trailed by the windfinders, with Shanella loudly insisting that they would provide a gateway only.
Birgitta whispered instructions to Gaibon before leaving him striding toward the front of the palace, while she hurried to the queen's stable-yard, where she found a hammer-nosed dun gelding wearing her saddle and waiting, the reins held by a young groom with her hair in a braid not much different from her own. She also found all 121 guardswomen armored and mounted. Climbing into the dun saddle, she motioned them to follow her. The sun was a golden ball clear of the horizon in a sky with only a few high white clouds. At least they would not have rain to contend with, too. Even a wagon might have been able to slip away in some of the heavy rainstorms Camelin had seen lately. A thick snake of men, 10 and 12 abreast, spanned the Queen's Plaza now, stretching out of sight in both directions, horsemen in helmets and breastplates, alternating with men in every sort of helmet imaginable, carrying shouldered halberds, most wearing mail shirts or jerkins sewn with steel discs, and only rarely a breastplate, each group large or small, headed by the banner of its house, or the banner of a mercenary company. The cell swords would have too many watchers to try slacking off today. Minus the crossbowmen and archers, there would be close on 12,000 men in that column, two-thirds of them mounted. How many would be dead before noon? She pushed that thought out of her mind. She needed every one of them to convince the sea folk. Any man who died today could die as easily on the wall tomorrow. Every man of them had come to Camelin prepared to die for Elaine. At the head of the column were better than 1,000 guardsmen, helmets and breastplates gleaming in the sun, steel-tipped lances slanted precisely, the first of them waiting behind the banner of Andor, the rearing white lion on a field of scarlet, and Elaine's banner, the golden lily on blue, at the edge of one of Camelin's many parks. It had been a park, anyway, but oaks hundreds of years old had been cut down and hauled away along with all the other trees and the flowering bushes, their roots dug out to clear a smooth space 100 paces wide. The graveled paths and grassy ground had long since been trampled to mud by hooves and boots. 3 other parks around the palace had received the same treatment to make places for weaving gateways. Gaibon and Dialin were already there, along with all the lords and ladies who had answered Elaine's call, from young Perival Mantiar to Brannin Martin and his wife, all mounted. Perival wore helmet and breastplate like every other male present. Brannin's were plain and dull and slightly dented where the armorer's hammer had failed its task, tools of his trade as surely as the plain-hilted sword scabbarded at his side. Perival's were as gilded as coniles and branlets, worked with the silver anvil of Mantiar, where theirs were lacquered with Northan's black eagles and Gilliard's red leopards. Pretty armor for being seen in. Birgitta hoped the women had sense enough to keep those boys out of any fighting. Looking at some of those women's faces, grim and determined, she hoped they had sense enough to stay clear themselves. At least none was wearing a sword. The simple truth was, a woman had to be more skilled than a man to face him with a sword. Stronger arms made too much difference otherwise. Much better to use a bow. The windfinders were grimacing as they shifted their bare feet uneasily on ground still muddy from yesterday's downpour. Wet they were more than accustomed to, but not mud. "This man will not tell me where the gateway is to reach," Shanella said furiously, pointing to Gaibon as Birgitta dismounted. "I want to be done so I can wash my feet." "My lady," a woman's voice called from back down the street. "My lady Birgitta!" Rena Harfor came running up the line of guardsmen, her red skirts held high, exposing her stockinged legs to the knee. Birgitta did not think she had ever seen the woman so much as trot. Mistress Harfor was one of those women who always did everything perfectly. Every time they met, she made Birgitta conscious of every last mistake she herself had ever made. 2 men in red and white livery were running behind her, carrying a litter between them. When they came closer, Birgitta saw that it held a lanky, helmetless guardsman with an arrow piercing his right arm and another jutting from his right thigh. Blood trickled down both shafts, so he left a thin trail of drops on the paving stones. "He insisted on being brought to you or Captain Gaibon immediately, my lady," Mistress Harfor said breathlessly, fanning herself with one hand. The young guardsman struggled to sit up until Birgitta pressed him back down. 3 or 4 companies of mercenaries are attacking the farm-adding gate, my lady," he said, pain racking his face and tinging his voice. "From inside the city, I mean. They placed archers to shoot anyone who tried to wave the signal flags for help. But I managed to get away, and my horse lasted just long enough." Birgitta growled an oath. Cordwyn, Gomaison, and Barkovan would be among them, she was ready to wager. She should have pressed Elaine to put them out of the city as soon as they made their demands. She did not realize she had spoken aloud until the wounded guardsman spoke up. "No, my lady. Leastwise, not Barkovan. Him and 12 or so of his men dropped by to pass the time, and the lieutenant figures they're the only reason we've managed to hold on, if they are still holding. They were using battering rams on the tower doors when I looked back. But there's more, my lady. There's men massing in Low Camelin outside the gates.
10,000, maybe twice that. Hard to tell the way those streets twist.
Birgitta winced. 10,000 men would be enough to carry an assault from the outside, whether or not the mercenaries were held off, unless she sent everything, and she could not. What in the light was she to do? Burn her? She could plan a raid to rescue someone from a fortress or scout in country held by the enemy with confidence that she knew what she was doing. But this was a battle, with the fate of Camelin and maybe the throne in the balance. Still, she had it to do. "Mistress Harford, take this man back to the palace and see his wounds tended, please." There was no point in asking the Windfinders for healing. They had already made it clear that was taking part in the war, in their view. "Dialin, leave me all of the horse and 1,000 halberdmen. You take the rest and all of the crossbowmen and archers available, and every man you can scrape together who can hold a sword. If the gate is still holding when the kinswomen get you there, make sure it continues to hold. If it's fallen, take it back, and hold that bloody wall till I can get there." "Very well," Dialin said, as if those were the easiest orders in the world to carry out. "Conyle, Catalin, Branlett, Perival, you come with me. Your foot will fight better with you there." Conyle looked disappointed, no doubt seeing himself riding in a gallant charge, but he gathered his reins and whispered something that made the two younger boys chuckle. "So will my horse fight better," Catalin protested. "I want to help rescue Elaine." "You came to help her secure the throne," Dialin said sharply, "and you'll go where you're needed to see to that, or you and I will have another talk later." Whatever that meant, Catalin's plump face reddened, but she sullenly followed Dialin and the others when they rode away. Gaibon looked at Birgitta, yet he said nothing, though likely he was wondering why she was not sending more. He would not challenge her publicly. The problem was she did not know how many Black Sisters would be with Elaine. She needed every Windfinder, needed them to believe they were all necessary. Had there been time, she would have stripped the entries from the outer towers, stripped even the gates. "Make the gateway," she told Shanella, "to just this side of the ridge east of the city, right on top of the Arranen Road and facing away from the city." The Windfinders gathered in a circle, doing whatever they had to do to link and taking their bloody time about it. Suddenly the vertical silver-blue slash of a gateway appeared, widening into an opening, 5 paces tall, and covering the whole width of the cleared ground that showed a wide road of hard-packed clay climbing the gentle slope of the 10-span-high ridge on its way to the River Arranen. Aramilla had camps beyond that ridge. Given the news, they might be empty. With luck, they were. But she could not concern herself with them now in any event. "Forward and deploy as ordered," Gaibon shouted, and spurred his tall bay through, followed by the gathered nobles and the guardsmen 10 abreast. The guardsmen began curling off to the left and out of sight, while the nobles took a position a little up the ridge. Some began peering toward the city through looking glasses. Gaibon dismounted and ran, crouching to peer over the crest through his. Birgitta could almost feel the impatience of the guardswomen waiting behind her. "You did not need a gateway this large," Shanella said, frowning at the column of horsemen flowing into the gateway. "Why, come with me," Birgitta said, taking the Windfinder by her arm. "I want to show you something." Pulling the dun along by his reins, she began drawing the woman toward the gateway. "You can come back once you've seen it." If she knew the least thing about Shanella, she was the one guiding the circle. For the rest, she was counting on human nature. She did not look back, yet she nearly sighed with relief when she heard the other Windfinders murmuring among themselves behind her, following. Whatever Gaibon had seen, it was good news, because he straightened up before running back down to his horse. Aramilla must have stripped her camps to the bone. Make it 20,000 at the Farmadding Gate, then, if not more. The light send it was holding. The light send everywhere was holding. But Elaine first. First and above all else. When she reached Gaibon, who was back on his bay, the guardswomen arrayed themselves in 3 lines behind Casela off to one side. The whole 100-pace width of the gateway was filled with men and horses now, trotting as they hurried left and right to join the others already forming in 3 ranks that grew to either side of the road. Good. There would be no easy way for the Windfinders to duck back through for a little while.
a wagon with an arched canvas cover and a four-horse team, surrounded by a small mounted party, was halted in the road just beyond the last buildings of Low Camelin, perhaps a mile distant. Beyond it, people bustled in the open brick markets that lined the road, going about their lives as best they could, but they might as well not have existed. Elaine was in that wagon. Birgitta raised her hand without taking her eyes from the vehicle, and Gaibon put his brass-mounted looking-glass in her palm. Wagon and riders leaped closer when she raised the tube to her eye.
"What did you want me to see?" Shanella demanded.
"In a moment," Birgitta replied. There were four men, three of them mounted, but more important were the seven women on horseback. It was a good-looking glass, but not good enough for her to make out an ageless face at that distance. Still, she had to assume all seven were Aes Sedai. Eight against seven might have seemed almost even odds, but not when the eight were linked. Not if she could make the eight take part.
What were the Dark Friends thinking, seeing thousands of soldiers and armsmen appear from behind what would seem to them a heat haze hanging in the air?
She lowered the glass. Noblemen were beginning to ride down as their armsmen came out and went to join the lines. However surprised the Dark Friends were, they did not dither long. Lightning began flashing down out of a clear sky, silver-blue bolts that struck the ground with thunderous crashes and threw men and horses like splashed mud. Horses reared and plunged and screamed, but men fought to control their mounts, to hold their places. No one ran. The booming thunder that accompanied those blasts struck Birgitta like blows, staggering her. She could feel her hair stirring, trying to rise out of her braid. The air smelled sharp. It seemed to tingle. Again lightning lashed the ranks. In Low Camelin, people were running away. Most were running away, but some fools actually ran to where they could have a better view. The ends of narrow streets opening onto the countryside began filling with spectators.
"If we're going to face that, we might as well be moving and make it harder for them," Gaibon said, gathering his reins. "With your permission, my lady."
"We'll lose fewer if you're moving," Birgitta agreed, and he spurred down the ridge.
Kasela halted her horse in front of Birgitta and saluted, an arm across her chest. Her narrow face was grim behind the face bars of her lacquered helmet.
"Permission for the bodyguard to join the line, my lady?"
You could hear the capital. They were not just any bodyguard. They were the daughter heir's bodyguard, and would be the queen's bodyguard.
"Granted," Birgitta said. "If anyone had a right, these women did."
The Arafelin whirled her horse and galloped down the slope, followed by the rest of the bodyguard to take their place in those lightning-torn ranks. A company of mercenaries, perhaps 200 men in black-painted helmets and breastplates, riding behind a red banner bearing a running black wolf, halted when they saw what they were riding into. But men behind the banners of half a dozen houses pushed past them, and they had no choice but to go on. More noblemen rode down to lead their men, Brannan and Kelwyn, Laerid and Beryl, others. None hesitated once he saw his own banner appear. Sergei's was not the only woman to move her horse a few paces, as if she, too, meant to join with her armsmen when her banner came out of the gateway.
"At a walk!"
Gaibon shouted, to be heard over the explosions. All along the line other voices echoed him.
"Advance!"
Wheeling his bay, he rode slowly toward the Dark Friend Aes Sedai, while lightning boomed and crashed and men and horses flew in fountains of earth.
"What did you want me to see?" Shanella demanded again. "I want to be away from this place."
Small danger of that for the moment. Men were still coming out of the gateway, galloping or running to catch up. Fireballs fell among the ranks, too, now, adding their own eruptions of dirt, arms, legs. A horse's head spun lazily into the air.
"This," Birgitta said, gesturing to the scene in front of them.
Gaibon had begun to trot, pulling the others with him, the three ranks holding steady in their advance, others coming as hard as they could to join them. Abruptly, a leg-thick bar of what appeared to be liquid white fire shot out from one of the women beside the wagon. It quite literally carved a gap 15 paces wide in the lines. For a heartbeat, shimmering flecks floated in the air. The shapes of men and horses struck, and then were consumed. The bar suddenly jerked up into the air, higher and higher, then winked out, leaving dim purple lines across Birgitta's vision. Balefire. Burning men out of the pattern so that they were dead before it struck them. She swung the looking-glass up to her eye long enough to spot the woman holding a slim black rod that appeared to be perhaps a pace long. Gibbon began to charge. It was too soon, but his only hope was to close while he still had men alive. His only hope but one. Over the thunderous explosions of fireballs and lightning rose a ragged cry of, "Elaine and Andor!" Ragged but full-throated. The banners were all streaming. A brave sight, if you could ignore how many were falling. A horse and rider struck squarely by a fireball simply disintegrated. Men and horses all around them going down as well. Some managed to rise again. A riderless horse stood on three legs, tried to run and fell over, thrashing. "This?" Shanella said incredulously. "I have no desire to watch men die." Another bar of balefire sliced a breach of nearly 20 paces in the charging ranks before knifing down into the ground, cutting a trench halfway back to the wagon before it vanished. There were a good many dead, though not so many as it seemed there should be. Birgitta had seen the same in battles during the Trolloc Wars where the power had been used. For every man who lay still, two or three were staggering to their feet or trying to stem a flow of blood. For every horse stiff-legged in death, two more stood on wobbly legs. The hail of fire and lightning continued unabated. "Then stop it," Birgitta said. "If they kill all the soldiers, or just enough to make the rest break, then Elaine is lost." Not forever. Burn her, she would track her for the rest of her life to see her free. But the light only knew what they might do to her in that time. "Zaida's bargain is lost. You will have lost it." The morning was not warm, yet sweat beaded on Shanella's forehead. Fireballs and lightning erupted among the riders following Gibbon. The woman holding the rod raised her arm again. Even without using the looking-glass, Birgitta was sure it was pointed straight at Gibbon. He had to see it, but he never swerved a hair. Suddenly another bolt of lightning slashed down and struck the woman holding the rod. She flew in one direction, her mount in another. One of the wagon team sagged to the ground while the others danced and reared. They would have run except for their dead tracemate. The other horses around the wagon were rearing and plunging too. The rain of fire and lightning ceased as the Aes Sedai fought to control their horses, to maintain their saddles. Rather than trying to calm his team, the man on the driver's seat leaped down and drew his sword as he began to run toward the charging horsemen. The onlookers in Low Camlan were running again too. This time away. "Take the others alive," Birgitta snapped. She did not much care whether they lived. They would die soon enough for being dark friends and murderers. But Elaine was in that bloody wagon. Shanella nodded stiffly, and around the wagon riders began toppling from their fractious mounts to lie struggling on the ground as if bound hand and foot. Which they were, of course. The running man fell on his face and lay writhing. "I shielded the women, too," Shanella said. Even holding the power, they would have been no match for a circle of eight. Gibbon raised his hand, slowing the charge to a walk. It was remarkable how short a time it all had taken. He was less than halfway to the wagon. Men mounted and afoot were still pouring out of the gateway. Swinging into the dun saddle, Birgitta galloped toward Elaine. "Bloody woman," she thought. The bond had never once carried any hint of fear. Chapter 33. 9 out of 10. The Dark Friends had taken no chances with Elaine. Aside from shielding her, Tamila had taken seemingly malicious pleasure in tying her in a tight knot with her head between her knees. Her muscles already ached from the cramped position. The gag, a dirty piece of rag with a vile, oily taste, tied so tightly that it dug into the corners of her mouth, had been meant to keep her from shouting for help at the gates. Not that she would have. All that would have done was sentence the men guarding the gates to death. She could feel the 6 Black Sisters holding Sidar until they were through the gate. But the blindfold had been an unnecessary touch. She thought they wanted to add to her sense of helplessness, yet she refused to feel helpless. After all, she was perfectly safe until her babies were born, and so were her babies. Min had told her so. She knew she was in a wagon or cart by the sound of harness and the feel of rough boards beneath her. They had not bothered to pad the floorboards with a blanket. A wagon, she thought. There seemed to be more than one horse pulling it. The wagon box smelled of old hay so strongly that she wanted to sneeze. Her situation seemed hopeless, but Birgitta would not fail her. She felt Birgitta leap from somewhere miles behind her to perhaps a mile ahead, and she wanted to laugh. The bond said Birgitta was aimed at her target, and Birgitta Silverbow never missed. When the channeling started on both sides of the wagon, the desire to laugh faded. Determination held rock steady in the bond, but there was something else as well now, a strong distaste and a rising, not anger, but close. Men would be dying out there. Instead of laughing, Elaine wanted to weep for them. They deserved someone to weep for them, and they were dying for her, as Van Deen and Saritha had died. Sadness for them welled up in her again. No guilt, though. Only by letting Phelan and Marilyn walk free could they have been spared, and neither would have countenanced that. There had been no way to anticipate the arrival of the others, or that strange weapon Asni had. A thunderous crash came close at hand, and her conveyance was jolted so violently that she bounced on the floorboards. Her knees and shins were going to be bruised from that. She sneezed in the dust that had risen with her, sneezed again. She could feel individual hairs lifting where they were not held down by the gag and blindfold. The air smelled peculiar. A lightning strike, it appeared. She hoped Birgitta had managed to involve the windfinders, unlikely as that seemed. The time would come when the kin would have to use the power as a weapon. No one could stand aside from Tarmon Gaiden, but let them preserve their innocence a little longer. Moments later, the shield on her vanished. Unable to see, she could not channel to any real purpose, but she could sense weaves near her, some of spirit, some of air. Without seeing the weaves, she was unable to know what they were, yet she could make a reasonable guess. Her captors were themselves captives now, shielded and bound, and all she could do was wait impatiently. Birgitta was coming closer rapidly, yet now she felt anxious to have that bloody web of ropes off her. The wagon box creaked as someone heaved herself in. Birgitta. The bond carried a flash of joy. In moments the ropes fell away from her, and Birgitta's hands went to the knot of the gag. Moving a little stiffly, Elaine untied the blindfold herself. Light, she was going to ache like fury until she could ask for healing. That reminded her that she would have to ask the Windfinders, and the sadness rose all over again for Van Deen and Saritha. Once she could spit out the gag, she wanted to ask for water to wash away the oily taste, but instead she said, "What kept you?" Her laughter at the other woman's sudden consternation was cut short by another sneeze. "Let's get out of here, Birgitta." "The kin?" "Windfinders," Birgitta answered, holding open the canvas flap at the back of the wagon. Chanella decided she'd rather not report losing her bargain to Zyda. Elaine sniffed in disdain. A mistake. Sneezing repeatedly, she climbed down from the wagon as quickly as she could manage. Her legs were as stiff as her arms. Burn her, but she wanted a hot bath and a hairbrush. Birgitta's white-collared red coat looked somewhat rumpled, but Elaine suspected she made her warder appear fresh from the dressing room. When her feet hit the ground, mounted guardsmen in a thick ring around the wagon raised a loud cheer, shaking their lances in the air. Guardswomen whooped, too, apparently almost every last one of them. Two of the men bore Andor's white lion and her golden lily. That brought a smile. The Queen's guards were sworn to defend Andor, the Queen, and the daughter heir, yet the decision to carry her personal banner had to have been Charles Gibbon's. Sitting a tall bay with his helmet resting on the saddle bow, he bowed to her, a broad smile on his lips. The man was a pleasure to look at. Perhaps he would do for a third warder. Beyond the guards rose house banners and banners of mercenary companies, banner after banner. Light! How many men had Birgitta brought? That could be answered later, though. First, Elaine wanted to see her prisoners. Asni lay spread-eagled on the road, her empty eyes staring at the sky. The shield on her was unneeded. The others lay as still, bound with flows of air that held their arms to their sides and snugged their divided skirts against their legs. A much more comfortable position than she had been in. Most seemed remarkably composed, considering their situation, though Tamila scowled at her, and Phelan appeared about to sick up. Cheyenne's mud-smeared face would have done credit to any Aes Sedai. The three men bound with air were anything but composed. They writhed and struggled, glaring at the riders surrounding them as if they wanted nothing more than to attack them all. That was enough to identify them as Asni's warders, though not necessarily as dark friends. Whether they were or not, they would still have to be imprisoned, to protect others from the death rage that Asni's death had filled them with. They would do anything to kill whomever they held responsible.
"How did they find us?" Chesmal demanded. If she had not been lying in the road with a dirty face, no one would have thought her a prisoner.
"My warder," Elaine said, smiling at Birgitta, one of them.
"A woman warder," Chesmal said disdainfully.
Marilyn shook in her bonds with silent laughter for a moment. "I'd heard that," she said when the shaking ceased, "but it seemed too incredible to be true."
"You heard this and you never mentioned it?" Tamila said, twisting around to transfer her scowl to Marilyn. "You great fool!"
"You forget yourself," Marilyn said sharply, and the next instant they were arguing about whether Tamila should defer to her.
In truth, Tamila should. Elaine could sense their relative strengths, yet it hardly seemed a topic they would argue over now.
"Somebody gag these women," Elaine ordered.
Casela dismounted, handing her reins to another guardswoman, and strode over to begin cutting a strip from Tamila's skirts with her dagger.
"Load them into the wagon and cut away that dead horse. I want to get back inside the walls before Aramilla's people beyond the ridge feel tempted."
The last thing she needed now was a pitched battle. Whatever the outcome, Aramilla could afford to lose more men than she.
"Where are the Windfinders, Birgitta?"
"Still on the ridge. I think they believe they can deny taking part if they don't get too near the carnage. But you don't have to worry about being attacked here. The camps beyond the ridge are empty."
Casela hoisted Tamila over her shoulder and staggered over to heave her into the wagon like a sack of grain. Guardswomen were picking up the other women, too. They wisely left the struggling warders to the guardsmen. It required two to handle each of them. A pair of tall guardsmen were unfastening the dead horse's harness.
"All I saw were camp followers, grooms and the like," Charles put in.
"I think all of her camps may be empty," Birgitta went on. "She sent heavy assaults against the northern wall this morning to draw as many of our men as possible, and she has 20,000 or more in Low Camelin below the Farmadding Gate. Some of the mercenaries changed colors and are attacking it from inside, but I sent Dial in with everything I could spare. As soon as you're safe inside the walls, I'll take the rest to help her. To add to the good news, Luan and the rest of that lot are riding north. They could be here this afternoon."
Elaine's breath caught. Luan and the rest would have to be dealt with when they appeared, but the other news...
"Do you remember what Mistress Harfour reported, Birgitta? Aramilla and the others all intend to be with the first party to ride into Camelin. They must be outside the Farmadding Gate, too. How many men do you have here?"
"What's the butcher's bill, Gaibon?" Birgitta asked, eyeing Elaine warily. The bond carried wariness, too, great wariness.
"I don't have a full tally yet, my lady. Some of the bodies..." Charles grimaced. "I'd say as many as 500 or 600 dead, though, perhaps a few more. Twice as many wounded, one way and another. As nasty a few minutes as I've ever seen."
"Call it 10,000, Elaine," Birgitta said, thick braids swaying as she shook her head. She tucked her thumbs behind her belt, and determination filled the bond.
"Aramilla has to have at least twice that at the Farmadding Gate, maybe 3 times if she's really stripped her camps. If you're thinking what I think you're thinking... I told Dialin to retake the gate if it had fallen, but it's more likely she's fighting Aramilla inside the city. If by some miracle the gate is holding, you're talking better than 2-to-1 odds against us."
"If they're through the gate," Elaine said stubbornly, "it's unlikely they closed it behind them. We'll take them in the rear." It was not all stubbornness, not entirely. She had not trained with weapons, but she had received all of the other lessons Gawain had gotten from Gareth Bryn. A queen had to understand the battle plans her generals gave her, rather than simply accept them blindly. "If the gate is holding, we'll have them trapped between us and the wall.
Numbers won't count so much in Low Camelin. Aramilla won't be able to line up any more men across a street than we can. We are going to do it, Birgitta. Now somebody find me a horse. For a moment she thought the other woman was going to refuse, which ratcheted up her stubbornness, but Birgitta exhaled heavily.
Saigon, catch up that tall gray mare for Lady Elaine.
It seemed that everyone around them except the Dark Friends sighed. They must have thought they were going to see a display of Elaine Tracan's fabled temper. Knowing that almost sparked one. Burn her bouncing moods. Stepping closer, Birgitta lowered her voice. But you'll ride surrounded by your bodyguard. This isn't some fool's story with a queen carrying her banner into battle to lead her troops. I know one of your ancestors did that, but you're not her, and you don't have a broken army to rally.
Why, that was exactly my plan, Elaine said sweetly. However did you guess?
Birgitta snorted with laughter and muttered, bloody woman, not quite softly enough to escape detection. Affection flowed in the bond, though. It was not so simple, of course. Men had to be told off to help the wounded. Some could walk, but many could not. Too many had tourniquets around the bloody stump of an arm or a leg. Charles and the nobles gathered around Elaine and Birgitta to hear the plan of attack, which was simple of necessity. But then Shanella refused to change the gateway until Elaine agreed that this time they need provide transport only, and sealed the agreement with them both kissing their fingertips and pressing them to the other's lips. Only then did the gateway dwindle to a vertical silvery slash and widen again into a 100-pace-wide view of Camelin from the south. There were no people in the brick markets lining the wide road that ran north from the gateway to the Farmadding Gate, but a great mass of men, mounted and afoot, crowded the road out of bowshot from the walls. The first of them was only a few 100 paces from the gateway. It appeared that they spilled into the side streets, too. The mounted men were to the front with a thicket of banners, but cavalry or infantry, they were all looking toward the gates of Camelin itself. The closed gates. Elaine could have shouted for joy. She rode through first, but Birgitta was taking no chances. Her bodyguard gathered around her, herding her off to one side. Birgitta was right by her side, but somehow they did not seem to be herding her. Fortunately, no one tried to object to her pushing the gray forward until only a single line of guardswomen was between her and the road. That line might as well have been a stone wall. The gray was indeed tall, however, so she could see without standing in the stirrups. She should have lengthened those. They were just a little short for her. That made this Chesmal's horse, since she was the only one who came close to her own height. A horse could not be tainted by its rider. Just because Chesmal was Black Aja did not make the horse evil, but she felt uncomfortable on the animal for more than short stirrups. The gray would be sold. The gray and all the other horses the Dark Friends had been riding, and the money distributed to the poor. Cavalry and foot came out of the gateway behind Charles, enough to fill it from side to side. Followed by the White Lion and the Golden Lily, he started up the road at a trot, with 500 guardsmen spread out to cover the width of the road. Other parties of similar size split off and vanished into the streets of Low Camelin. When the last men exited the gateway, it dwindled and vanished. Now there was no quick escape if anything went wrong. Now they had to win, or Aramilla would as good as have the throne whether or not she had Camelin. "We need Matt Cawthon's bloody luck today," Birgitta muttered.
"You said something like that before," Elaine said. "What do you mean?"
Birgitta gave her a peculiar look. The bond carried amusement. "Have you ever seen him dicing?"
"I hardly spend much time in places where there's dicing, Birgitta."
"Let's just say he's luckier than any other man I've ever met."
Shaking her head, Elaine put Matt Cawthon out of her mind. Charles's men were shutting off her view as they rode forward, not charging yet, trying to make no more noise than absolutely necessary. With a little luck, her men would have Aramilla's surrounded before they knew what was happening, and then they would hit Aramilla from every side. Matt was the luckiest man Birgitta had ever met? In that case, he must be very lucky indeed. Suddenly, Charles's guardsmen were moving faster, their steel-tipped lances swinging down. Someone must have looked back. Shouts rose, cries of alarm, and one thunderous shout she heard repeated from many directions.
Elaine and Andor!
There were other cries as well. The moons and the fox, the triple keys and the hammer and the black banner. Others for lesser houses. But from her side came only the one, repeated again and again.
Elaine and Andor!
Suddenly she was shaking, half laughing, half weeping. The light send she was not consigning those men to their deaths for nothing. The cries faded, largely replaced by the clash of steel on steel, by shouts and screams as men killed or died. Abruptly she realized the gates were swinging out, and she could not see. Kicking her feet free of the stirrups, she clambered up to stand on the high cantled saddle. The gray shifted nervously, unaccustomed to being a step-stool, but not enough to disturb her balance. Birgitta muttered a particularly pungent oath, but the next moment she was standing on her saddle, too. Hundreds of crossbowmen and archers were pouring out of the far-madding gate, but were they her men or the renegade mercenaries? For answer, archers began firing at Aramilla's massed cavalry as fast as they could knock and draw. The first crossbows went up and loosed a volley. Immediately, those men began working their cranks to rewind their crossbows, but others rushed past them to loose a second flight of bolts that cut down men and horses like scythes reaping barley. More archers spilled out of the gate, firing as fast as they could. A third rank of crossbow men ran forward to fire, a fourth, a fifth, and then men wielding halberds were pushing past the crossbowmen still running out of the gate. A halberd was a fearsome weapon, combining spear point and axe blade with a hook for pulling men out of the saddle. Horsemen with no room to charge their lances, their swords outreached by the halberd's long haft, began falling. Men in red coats and burnished breastplates were galloping out of the gate now, guardsmen swinging to left and right to find another way to get at Aramilla's ranks. The flow of them went on and on, unceasing. How in the light could Dailin have so many of the guards? Unless... Burn the woman. She must have scooped up the half-trained men. Well, half-trained or not, they would be anointed in blood today. Suddenly, three figures in gilded helmets and breastplates rode through the gates, swords in hand. Two of them were very small. The shouts that rose when they appeared were thin with distance, but still audible over the din of battle. The Black Eagles, and the Anvil, and the Red Leopards. Two mounted women appeared in the gate, struggling until the taller managed to pull the other's horse back out of sight. "Blood and bloody ashes," Elaine snapped. "Conyle's old enough, I suppose, but Branlett and Perivale are boys. Somebody should have kept them out of that."
"Dailin held them back long enough," Birgitta said calmly. The bond carried bone-deep calm. "Longer than I thought she could hold Conyle, and she did manage to keep Catelyn out of it. Anyway, the boys have a few hundred men between them and the forefront, and I don't see anyone trying to make room for them to squeeze forward."
It was true. The three were waving their swords impotently at least 50 paces from where men were dying. But then 50 paces was a short range for bow or crossbow. Men began appearing on the rooftops, first dozens, then hundreds, archers and crossbowmen climbing over the roof peaks, working their way across the slates like spiders until they could shoot down into the packed mass below. One slipped and fell, his body lying atop the men in the street and jerking as it was stabbed repeatedly. Another suddenly reared up, a shaft sticking out of his side, and toppled from his perch. He also lay atop the men in the street, twitching as he was stabbed again and again. "They're jammed together too tightly," Birgitta said excitedly. "They can't raise a bow, much less draw one. I'll wager the dead don't even have room to fall down. It won't be long now." But the slaughter continued for a good half hour before the first shouts of "Quarter!" rose. Men began hanging their helmets on sword hilts and raising them overhead, risking death in the hope of life. Footmen stripped off helmets and held their hands up empty. Horsemen flung down lances, helmets, swords, and raised their hands. It spread like a fever, the cry bellowing from thousands of throats. "Quarter!" Elaine sat down on her saddle properly. It was done. Now to learn how well it had been done. The fighting did not stop immediately, of course. Some tried to fight on, but they fought alone and died or were pulled down by men around them who were no longer ready to die. At last, however, even the most diehard began shedding weapons and armor, and if not every voice cried for quarter, the roar was still thunderous. Weaponless men shorn of helmets and breastplates and any other armor they might have worn began staggering through the line of guardsmen, hands above their heads. Halberdmen herded them like sheep. They had something of the stunned look of sheep in a slaughter yard. The same thing must have been being repeated on dozens of Low Camelin's narrow streets and at the gates, because the only shouts she heard were for quarter, and those were beginning to dwindle as men realized it was being granted. The sun lacked no more than an hour of its noonday peak by the time the nobles were all separated out. The lesser were escorted inside the city, where they would be held for ransom, to be paid once the throne was secure. The first of the greater nobles to be brought to her, escorted by Charles and a dozen guardsmen, were Aramilla, Nayan, and Elenia. Charles had a bloody gash down his left sleeve and a dent in his shining breastplate that must have been made by a hammer blow, but his features were composed behind the face bars of his helmet. She heaved a huge sigh of relief to see the three women. Among the dead or among the captives, the others would be found. She had decapitated her opposition, at least until Luan and the others arrived. The guardswomen in front of her at last moved aside so she could confront her prisoners. The three were garbed as if they had intended to attend Aramilla's coronation that very day. Her red silk dress was sewn with seed pearls on the bosom and embroidered with rearing white lions marching up the sleeves. Swaying in her saddle, she had the same stunned look in her brown eyes that her soldiers had. Nayan, slim and straight-backed in blue with the silver triple keys of a rawn climbing her sleeves and silver scrollwork across her bosom, her gleaming black hair caught in a silver net set with sapphires, seemed subdued rather than numb. She even managed to sneer, though it was weak. Honey-haired Elenia, in green elaborately embroidered with gold, shared her glares between Aramilla and Elaine. The bond carried equal measures of triumph and disgust. Birgitta's dislike of these women was as personal as Elaine's own. "You will be my guests at the palace for the time being," Elaine told them. "I hope your coffers are deep. Your ransoms will pay for this war you've caused." That was malicious of her, but she felt spiteful all of a sudden. Their coffers were not deep at all. They had borrowed far more than they could repay in order to hire mercenaries and bribe mercenaries. They faced ruin without any ransom. With, they faced devastation. "You cannot believe it ends this way," Aramilla said hoarsely. She sounded as if she were trying to convince herself. "Jared is still in the field with a considerable force. Jared and others, tell her, Elenia." "Jared will try to preserve what he can of Saran from this disaster you forced us into," Elenia snarled. They began shouting at one another, but Elaine ignored them. She wondered how they would enjoy sharing a bed with Nayan. Next to appear under escort was Lyr Baran, and moments later, Corinne Anshar. As slender as a blade and as strong, Lyr wore a thoughtful expression rather than defiant or sullen. His green coat, embroidered with the silver-winged hammer of House Baran on the high collar, bore the marks of the breastplate he was no longer wearing, and his dark hair was matted with sweat. More glistened on his face. He had not gotten so sweaty watching other men fight. Karind was garbed as grandly as the other women, in shimmering blue silk, heavy with silver braid, and pearls in her gray-streaked hair. Her square face looked resigned, especially after Elaine told them about their ransoms. Neither had borrowed as heavily as the other three, so far as she knew, but that ransom would still cut deep. Then two guardsmen appeared, with a woman a little older than Elaine, in simple blue, a woman she thought she recognized. A single enameled brooch, a red star and silver sword on glittering black, appeared to be her only jewelry. But why was Sylvaise Cairn being brought to her? A pretty woman with alert blue eyes that held steady on Elaine's face, she was Lord Nason's heir, not the high seat of Cairn. "Cairn stands for Trakand," Sylvaise said shockingly as soon as she reined in. The bond echoed Elaine's startlement. Aramilla gaped at Sylvaise as if she were mad. "My grandfather suffered a seizure, Aramilla," the young woman said calmly, "and my cousins fell over themselves, affirming me as high seat. I will publish it, Elaine, if you wish." "That might be best," Elaine said slowly. publication would make her support irrevocable. This would not be the first time a house had switched sides, even without the death of a high seat, but best to be certain. Trakand welcomes Cairn warmly, Sylvaes. Best not to be too distant, either. She knew little of Sylvaes Cairn. Sylvaes nodded, accepting. So she had at least a degree of intelligence. She knew she would not be fully trusted until she demonstrated her loyalty by sending out the proclamations of support. If you trust me a little, may I have custody of Aramilla, Nayan, and Alania? In the royal palace, of course, or wherever you choose to house me. I believe my new secretary, Master Lunalt, may be able to convince them to throw their support to you. For some reason, Nayan gave a loud cry and would have fallen from her saddle if a guardsman had not grabbed her arm to support her. Aramilla and Alania both appeared ready to sick up. I think not, Elaine said. No proposed conversation with a secretary produced those reactions. It seemed Sylvaes had a hard core to her. Nayan and Alania have published their support of Aramilla. They'll hardly destroy themselves by recanting. That truly would destroy them. Smaller houses sworn to them would begin falling away until their own house dwindled in importance. They themselves might not survive as high seats much beyond announcing that they now stood for Trakand. And as for Aramilla, Elaine would not allow Aramilla to change her tune. She would refuse the woman's support if it were offered. Something grim entered Sylvaes' gaze as she glanced at the three women. They might, with the proper persuasion. Oh yes, a very hard core. But as you wish, Elaine. Be very careful of them, though. Treachery is in their blood and bones.
Barin stands for Trakand, Lear announced suddenly. I too will publish it, Elaine.
Anshar stands for Trakand, Karin said in firm tones. I will send the proclamations out today.
Traitors! Aramilla cried. I'll see you dead for this!
She fumbled at her belt where a dagger's scabbard hung, jeweled and empty, as if she intended to see to the matter herself. Elania began to laugh, but she did not sound amused. It sounded almost like weeping. Elaine drew a deep breath. Now she had 9 of the 10 houses needed. She was under no illusions. Whatever Sylvaes's reasons, Lear and Karin were trying to salvage what they could by cutting themselves loose from a lost cause and hitching themselves to one that suddenly appeared to be rising. They would expect her to give them preferment for standing for her before she had the throne, while forgetting that they had ever supported Aramilla. She would do neither. But neither could she reject them out of hand. Trakand welcomes Barin. Never warmly, though, never that. Trakand welcomes Anshar. Captain Gaibon, get the prisoners into the city as soon as you can. Armsmen for Cairn, Barin, and Anshar will be restored their weapons and armor once the proclamations have been sent out. But they can have their banners back now. He saluted her and wheeled his bay, already shouting orders. As she heeled the gray toward Dailin, who was riding out of a side street, followed by Catalin and the 3 young fools in their gilded armor, Sylvaes, Lear, and Karin fell in behind her and Birgitta. She felt no disquiet having them at her back, not with 100 guardswomen at theirs. They would be watched very closely until those proclamations were sent, including Sylvaes. Elaine's mind was already casting itself ahead. "You're awfully quiet," Birgitta said softly. "You've just won a great victory." "And in a few hours," she replied, "I'll learn whether I have to win another."
Chapter 34 A Cup of Cough. Ferric Caride pressed his gauntleted fist to his heart, returning the sentry's salute, and ignored the fact that the man spat as he rode past. He hoped the 80 men and 21 Ogier behind him ignored it too. They had better, if they knew what was good for them. He was here for information, and a killing would make getting it more difficult. Since his manservant Ajimbura had planted his knife in a standard-bearer's heart over a perceived insult to his master, in truth a real insult, but Ajimbura should have held his temper the way he himself had. Since then he had taken to leaving the wiry little hill tribesman in the forest with the Suldam and Dimani and some of the guards to watch over the pack horses when he entered a camp. He had come a long way from Ebu Dar chasing the wind, almost 4 weeks of harrying after rumors, until the news brought him here to this camp in east central Altara. The neat rows of pale tents and horse lines stood in a forest clearing large enough for Rakan to land. But there was no sign of Rakan or flyers, no ground company with its wagons and Rakan grooms. But then, he had not seen a Rakan in the skies for some time now. Supposedly, almost all had been sent west. Why, he did not know and did not care. The High Lady was his goal and his entire world. A tall, thin message pole cast its long shadow in the early morning sun, though, so there must be Rakan somewhere about. He thought the camp might contain 1,000 men, not counting farriers and cooks and the like. Interestingly, every last soldier he could see wore familiar armor from home, rather than those solid breastplates and barred helmets. Practice was to pad out most forces with men from this side of the ocean. It was interesting that they were all armored, too. A rare commander kept his soldiers in armor, unless he expected action soon. From the rumors he had picked up, that might be the case here. Three flagstaffs marked the command tent, a tall, walled affair of pale canvas with air vents along the peak that doubled as smoke holes. No smoke issued from them now, for the morning was only a little cool, though the sun hung not far above the horizon. On one flagstaff, the blue-bordered imperial banner hung in limp folds, hiding the spread-winged golden hawk clutching lightning in its talons. Some commanders hung it from a horizontal staff, so it was always visible in full, but he thought that ostentatious. The other two banners, on shorter flanking staffs, would be of the regiments these men belonged to. Karid dismounted in front of that tent and removed his helmet. Captain Musenj emulated him, revealing a grim expression on his weathered face. The other men climbed down, too, to rest their horses and stood by their animals. The Ogier gardeners leaned on their long-hafted, black-tasseled axes. Everyone knew they would not be staying long. "Keep the men out of trouble," he told Musenj. "If that means accepting insults, so be it." "There'd be fewer insults if we killed a few of them," Musenj muttered. He had been in the Death Watch guards even longer than Kareed, though his hair was unbroken black, and he would suffer insults to the Empress, might she live forever, as gladly as insults to the guards. Hartha scratched one of his long gray mustaches with a finger the size of a fat sausage. The first gardener, commander of all the Ogier in the High Lady Tuan's bodyguard, was almost as tall as a man in the saddle and wide with it. His red and green lacquered armor contained enough steel to make armor for 3 or 4 humans. His face was as dour as Musenge's, yet his booming voice was calm. Ogier were always calm, except in battle. Then they were as cold as deep winter in Jeranem.
"After we rescue the High Lady, we can kill as many of them as need killing, Musenj."
Recalled to his duty, Musenj flushed from having allowed himself to stray.
"After," he agreed.
Kareed had schooled himself too hard over the years, had been schooled too hard by his trainers to sigh, but had he been other than a Death Watch guard, he might have done so now. Not because Musenj wanted to kill someone, and almost anyone would do. Rather, it was because the insults he had walked away from these past weeks chafed him as much as they did Musenj and Hartha. But the guards did whatever was necessary to carry out their assignments, and if that meant walking away from men who spat on the ground at the sight of armor in red and the dark green most called black, or dared to murmur about lowered eyes in his hearing, then walk away he must. Finding and rescuing the High Lady Tuan was all that mattered. Everything else was dross beside that.